Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 1056, interview number 25 with Jim DiGenio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on February 5th of the year 2019. And once again, it is my privilege and my pleasure to bring back for our penultimate interview Jim DiGenio, the author of, among other titles, The Triumphal Destiny Betrayed, which is the focal point of our discussions. Jim, welcome back to our airwaves.
Good evening, Dave.
In our last two interviews, we have been talking about how JFK's foreign policy, particularly in the what has become known as the Third World, was reversed by LBJ's ascension after JFK's assassination. And we were talking about Indonesia. One of the companies that was able to reap tremendous economic bounty from Indonesia once Sukarno was overthrown, that following Kennedy's assassination, Kennedy was working with Sukarno, that was Freeport Sulfur. We earlier looked at Freeport Sulfur in connection with Cuba, and both David Ferry and Clay Shaw networked with Freeport Sulfur. I wonder if you would review Freeport Sulfur, Shaw, Ferry, and Cuba for us.
Yeah, sure. The Freeport Sulfur was a very important corporation that was located at first, its major offshore entity was in Cuba. But then when Castro began to nationalize most of the industries there, they had a plan to circumnavigate the embargo through that Shaw was going to be involved in importing the raw materials in from Canada to a smelting company outside of New Orleans. That's what they were going to. That's how they were going to do it. And so Ferry had flown Shaw up to Canada a couple of times to do work for the company. Now, when Castro essentially communized all of Cuba, those plans kind of went awry, and they began to shift their operations to Indonesia. All right. Now, in Indonesia, they went ahead and they concentrated on these huge amounts of copper that were in something called the Grasberg.
Erzberg, E-R-S-T-B-E-R-G, a mountain.
Yeah, the Erzberg and then the Grasberg.
Okay.
Okay. And so they realized, and this is really good part of Greg Bulgarin's book, which I said was going to be published this fall. They realized that these were incredible deposits of not just copper, but of silver and gold and a lesser amount of petroleum in this new possession that Kennedy had made the Netherlands give back to Sukarno on the island of West Irion. And so they were very keen, of course, to see Sukarno overthrown, all right? And Augustus Long, who you mentioned earlier, was on the FIAB. Now, why is that important? Because the FIAB advises both the president and the CIA, all right, Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. Very shortly after Kennedy was killed, two things happened. Number one, the aid bill that he had designed for Indonesia stopped on Johnson's desk. It didn't proceed. And that was a very important aid bill. Kennedy was a close friend of the British economist Barbara Ward. Barbara Ward was very interested in helping third world countries get out of a poverty cycle and begin to revive their economies. And she said they could only do this if they were given aid. And Kennedy was a big fan of hers, and they talked about this specific problem. Well, that aid program didn't go anywhere after Kennedy was killed. And then Augustus Long was on the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, and he got Johnson to cancel the trip that Kennedy had scheduled to go to Jakarta in 1964. So very clearly, Sukarno gets the message, something is up here, all right? And so what happens is that Freeport Sulphur, which eventually becomes named Freeport-McMoRan, all right, for a lot of people believe Freeport Sulphur understood that the coup was coming before it started. And there's some evidence for that, okay? And they, of course, were one of the huge beneficiaries of the overthrow of Sukarno in 1965. And they went ahead, once that was done, all right, they went ahead and designed ways to get into the first the Erzberg and then the Grasberg mines. And they, to give you just one quick example, in just one year, the Grasberg mine had a total wealth between gold, silver, and copper of close to $4 billion in just one year. All right. Now, if they're doing a 90-10 split with Suharto, you can see how much money Freeport-McMoRan was making from this operation. And see, this is one thing that I hope people understand, that this whole idea that the Cold War was simply communism versus democracy, no, there was a heck of a lot more to the Cold War than just that. That's what they used to sell it, you know, to the masses. You know, the people at the very top, okay, were fighting the Cold War for a whole different reason, all right? Sukarno was not a communist. He never was a communist, all right? He never was going to be a communist. But the fact that he was a nationalist meant that he stood in the way of Freeport Sulphur making tons of money. And that's what really that was all about.
And again, in Cuba, that working on behalf of Freeport Sulphur was one of the areas where David Ferry and Clay Shaw were networking with each other and with Freeport. We spoke in an earlier interview, Jim, about Kennedy's policy vis-a-vis Cuba. I wonder if you would review that for us and also mention quite predictably, how CIA and related elements responded to that.
All right. In a nutshell, to take it up to 1963, Kennedy did not invade Cuba when he had a perfect opportunity to do so at the Bay of Pigs. All right. When everyone saw the operation failing, you know, people in the CIA, Admiral Burke, et cetera, okay, tried to urge him on to go ahead and send in the Navy to save the day. He didn't do it, all right? And then afterwards, he discovered he is very badly misled, and then he canned Alan Dulles, Charles Cabell, the deputy director, and Dick Bissell, the director of plans.
Jim, very briefly, wasn't Arleigh Burke also part of the Freeport management structure of labor? I believe, wasn't that the company he was also involved with?
He might have been on the board. I think he was on the board of directors.
Yeah, labor. So he had, in addition to a military interest, he had a monetary interest as well eventually.
Right.
Okay, go ahead.
All right. So then the next year, when everybody's telling Kennedy to go into Cuba and invade over the missile crisis, he again doesn't do it, right? He takes the least escalatory option, which is the blockade, all right? And then he creates a back channel between his brother and the Russian ambassador, all right? And that ends up being very helpful in solving the crisis. All right. And so, in other words, when Kennedy had prime opportunities and when almost everybody else would have gone in, he didn't go in. Now, at the end of the missile crisis, what happens is that once Kennedy is getting out a lot of the guys that were taken prisoner after the Bay of Pigs through attorney James Donovan, Cuba, through Castro, sends a kind of message to Kennedy. See, Castro was upset because he didn't like the way Khrushchev had essentially sloughed him off in solving the crisis. In other words, he didn't ask Castro about any of the solutions he was proposing with Kennedy. He just thought that he would accept them. And Castro was very upset. That's why he didn't allow any on-site inspections, okay, during the, and so they had to do it through U-2 flights. And so what happened is that Castro begins to think that maybe I should try for something directly with Kennedy. And Kennedy's interested, all right? And so they begin to set up certain proxies, which they go through, all right? And, you know, one of them is William Atwood, a former ambassador to Ghana, all right? And it was Atwood who more or less begins to set up meetings between himself and the Cuban ambassador at the United Nations. And they begin to map out this unbelievable kind of detente, all right, between Cuba and the United States, all right? They even go as far as planning meetings in which Atwood is going to fly down to Mexico City and then take a plane into Havana to meet with Castro himself, all right? This was the meetings were set up by the ABC News reporter, Lisa Howard, all right, who was another go-between. All right, then the third intermediary is a guy named John Daniel, who, by the way, is still alive, if you can believe it. He's a Frenchman, and he's still working at a major newspaper over there in France, or excuse me, magazine. And so Atwood calls in John Daniel in, I think, October, because Daniel's going to take a trip to Cuba. And Kennedy tells Daniel that I want you to give a message to Castro for me, all right? And he goes ahead and makes about a five-minute speech saying that he understands the horrible policy the United States had towards Cuba prior to the revolution. Okay, but he wants Castro to understand that they're caught up in the middle of the Cold War, which we saw what happened with the missile crisis. And he wants to make a deal with him that they can coexist as long as he doesn't try and spread communism into the rest of South America. All right? And so Daniel goes ahead, memorizes the speech that he wants to give him, flies down to Cuba, meets with Castro, and he goes, then when he meets with him, he goes, I'm carrying a message from the president. And he goes, okay, what is it? And he goes on and tells him everything he said. And Castro, if you read Daniel's article, which I think was in the New Republic a few weeks after Kennedy was killed, Castro was really taken aback. He goes, wow, this is an American president talking like this to me? You know, this is amazing. He goes, if this all goes through, Kennedy will be the greatest president since Lincoln. You know, he's overjoyed. So he picks him up the next day, and Danielle said, Castro's still exuberant. He's talking about what a great, great guy Kennedy is and how things are all going to be different now. All right? And so they go to some hamburger place or something for lunch, and the news comes on the radio, all right, about what happened in Dallas, okay, and somebody calls Castro, and he tells him Kennedy's been shot, And he goes, oh, no. Oh, no. All right. So he hangs up. A few minutes later, calls him back again. Kennedy's dead. And Castro, according to Danielle, Castro put his face in his hands, and he said three times, this is bad news. This is bad news. This is bad news. Then he looked up at him and said, everything is going to change now. Everything. All right? And by the way, that night, if you can believe this, that night he went on television. It was either that night or the next day. And he analyzed the whole thing. Okay? And it's amazing how close he got to what had happened. He goes, this Oswald is no communist. What kind of communist, you know, goes into the FBI office, you know, because they obviously had spies there in New Orleans, in Dallas, et cetera. Okay? He's obviously some kind of provocateur.
Sure.
Because they're going to use this to blame us. That's what's going to happen. That's what this was all about. And this guy's working for the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in New Orleans? Okay, so that was what happened. He was exactly right, of course. That's what happened. And by the way, Dave, he made another speech 3 days later in which he examined the whole thing even more. Okay? With everything at Castro, the guy really was a political swami. Okay? He had the Kennedy assassination figured out within 5 days. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, what happened is, just what he said, everything changed after that. The whole thing, the whole quest for rapprochement between Castro and Kennedy went down the drain. And it wasn't resumed until, what, 2014? 2015?
Yeah, Obama, decades later, the best report of a half century later, moved to normalize relations with Castro. The point being that Kennedy's rapprochement died with him. And once again, the Cold War consensus was reinstituted vis-a-vis Cuba.
By the way, that's exactly what Atwood said. Atwood said the Cuban detente died in Dallas. Okay.
Yep. Absolutely. And you know what is interesting as something of a pivot point? Not only was Kennedy moving to achieve a rapprochement with Castro, but something that you mentioned, and this is something of a pivot point, two things you mentioned, Jim, is that the Kennedy family had a backdoor communication channel with the Soviet leadership, with Nikita Khrushchev, and they indicated that they did not believe that the Soviets or the Cubans were involved. Recall that a few weeks ago we talked about the Mexico City gambit in which, quote, Oswald, unquote, was made out to be networking with the Cubans and Valery Kostikov, the KGB's master of assassinations for the Western Hemisphere, and how this was used to cover up the JFK assassination. Yeah, you also wrote glowingly and very positively, you know, I was very pleased to see that, about James Douglas's book, JFK and the Unspeakable, subtitled Why He Died and Why It Matters. I wonder if you would tell us first about Kennedy's communication to the Kennedy family, I should say, is communication to the Soviet leadership, and then talk something about Kennedy's policies vis-a-vis the former Soviet Union, because Douglas brings up some very important points from his stymieing his Joint Chiefs in 61, perhaps saving the whole world, to the nuclear test ban, to the atmospheric test ban treaty. So we'll start with the Kennedy family and their communications to Khrushchev right after the killing.
All right. What you're talking about there occurred in 1961 when Alan Dulles and Lyman Lemnitzer, the director of the CIA, and Lemnitzer was the chair of the Joint Chiefs, when they proposed to Kennedy that this would be the optimum time to exercise a first strike against the Soviet Union. In other words, an all-out attack with atomic weapons against Russia. All right? Reportedly, Kennedy stayed at the meeting for about 5 minutes, all right, listened to everything, and then without a word just walked out, and he told Dean Rusk words to the effect, and they call us the human race. All right?
This is a point, Jim, I think we should emphasize, because you know, people were told, well, Kennedy was this, he was a cold warrior, blah, blah, blah. Even if none of the other things we've spoken about had taken place, when he turned back Dulles and the Joint Chiefs' moves to launch a first strike on the Soviet Union, he basically saved the world. Even if the Soviets didn't get off a single missile, the radiation, the nuclear winter that would have resulted from something like that. One of the things about nuclear doctrine, the U.S. and Soviet Union targeted each other's nuclear power plant. It would have been the end of the world, and Kennedy stopped it.
Right, right. And so from there, after the missile crisis, Kennedy began to work on, number one, the partial nuclear test ban, which he did, moved hell and high water to get that passed, and I think it passed in August, which was really the first really substantial arms control move, you know, by a president of the United States. Very important because, you know, they were actually testing weapons out in the open, you know, like in deserts and places like that. And all that radiation was getting out, you know, into the atmosphere. And this is something that Kennedy wanted to stop, which I think, you know, it was a very good idea myself.
Oh, absolutely. Right? For younger listeners, they used to, both the U.S. and Soviet Union, would test nuclear weapons in the atmosphere so that the fallout, all of the radioactive isotopes, would work their way into the ecosphere. Kennedy is described by James Douglas as conferring with an advisor, I forget who, but he asks, you mean the radiation is in the rain that's falling? And the advisor said, yes, Mr. President, it's in the rain. The point being that not only is that amazing, just unthinkably wicked from an environmental standpoint, but even today, given the half-lives of some of those radioactive isotopes, there are people in the U.S., the former Soviet Union, and around the world getting cancers from long-lived radioactive isotopes that were blasted into the ecosphere from those tests. And not only did Kennedy put a halt to that, but that was bitterly opposed by the Joint Chiefs and associated elements. They hated that idea.
Right. So Kennedy works on that in 1963, all right? And then he's establishing a hotline, okay, between himself and Khrushchev, a direct hotline between the two countries, where instead of having to go through third parties like they did in the missile crisis, they could communicate with each other directly. And then there is also this thing that Jim Douglas wrote about, the sacred triumvirate, in which Kennedy, Khrushchev, and the Pope began to arrange a detente between the three countries with, I forget his name, the editor of Saturday Review, Norman Cousins. He was like the go-between, getting that correspondence through. And so this is something that Bobby Kennedy knew about, okay, because by 1963, Bobby Kennedy was really JFK's most trusted advisor once he figured out that he really couldn't trust 90% of the people in his own cabinet.
And by the way, okay, the Pope at the time was Pope John the 23rd.
Right, right. And so what happens next is that after Kennedy is killed, Bobby Kennedy, you know, does his own little investigation, you know, and he begins to call in people like McCone, you know, like some of the Cuban exiles. And about, I think it's about a week after the assassination, November the 29th, I think is the day, or the 30th, Bobby Kennedy and Jackie Kennedy call in William Walton, who's kind of a cultural advisor in Washington, in the administration, who has a trip scheduled to Moscow. They call him over to Bobby Kennedy's home, okay, Hickory Hill, and they're waiting for him in the dining room. And he comes in, they're sitting there, and they give him a letter. And in this letter, it says, "We understand that my brother's assassination was not solely the result of this Lee Harvey Oswald guy. There was a bigger, more malignant right-wing force behind it. And that force is going to break up my brother's attempt for detente between the United States and the Kremlin. I will go ahead and drop out of the administration, since I think Lyndon Johnson is too beholden to big business to continue that detente. I will then run for office, and then I will go ahead and run for the presidency again, and then we can go back on track to pursue my brother's endeavors with you." Now, is that the most amazing letter you ever heard of? Here is Bobby Kennedy. He can talk more privately and openly with the Russians about what his brother was doing than he can with the Americans. All right?
It is amazing and betokens not only what we lost, let alone JFK, but with his brother who was killed by the same forces, but the departure from what is considered the norm at this point in time, let alone back then, for someone to do what Bobby Kennedy and Jackie were doing.
Right, right. You know, really, really amazing, you know, when you really think of it. And so, of course, Khrushchev, when he went in to sign his condolences at the American embassy, when he went in there, reportedly, he was weeping, you know, because he understood, you know, just what had been lost, you know, with Kennedy's death. And, of course, 1 year later, he was deposed. All right? He was out. All right? So that's – see, whenever somebody tells you that, oh, one man really can't make a difference – okay, well, one man can make a difference if he's the right guy.
Oh, absolutely. Right? Absolutely. It is one of the things that is really important for all people to understand, but particularly young people, is because he was doing Kennedy, and time permitting, we'll get to some of his domestic policies, but he was doing things that were absolutely revolutionary. Not that he was going to set up a communist, this, that, and the other thing, but he was departing in a fundamental way from the primary national security and corporate vector of his time. And the world would have been a much better place had he been able to succeed, but there was no way he was going to be allowed to do that.
Correct. And in fact, all you have to do is look over what happened in Tampa, Chicago, and then Dallas, and you understand Kennedy's not making it out of 1963. You know? They're going to kill him one way or the other.
Yeah, it is amazing to look at this from the perspective of decades later. Kennedy was tremendously enlightened, but to the powers that be, he would have been seen as a card-carrying red. Jim Douglas also mentions that Kennedy was moving to explore space in conjunction with the Soviet Union.
Right. That was actually in 1963 where he made a proposal that they do a dual mission, okay, into outer space. Now, if you can believe this, I did a little more research on this. Kennedy actually wanted to do that in 1961 because for the simple matter that when he looked at the budget that NASA had proposed, he says, wait a minute, this is really expensive. You know, why don't we do this in conjunction with the Russians? And if you can believe it, but it's true, the Russians turned it down in 1961. So he proposed it again in 1963.
And I bet that set Wernher von Braun and Walter Dornberg and people to do the varsity rag, you know?
Talk about a pork barrel. NASA was the biggest pork barrel you could imagine, you know?
And you mentioned, Jim, that Kerry Thornley and some other people in who figured in Jim Garrison's investigation were networking with NASA, and that some of the key interviews they wanted to conduct were going to be at a NASA facility in southern Louisiana. You know, Jim, we have a little less than a half hour left.
You want to talk about Kennedy's civil rights program?
Some of his domestic policies, yes, because it wasn't just in the areas of foreign policy that he was dramatically departing from the norm. But this February is Black History Month, and I remember an article on Kennedy's and King that you penned, I believe it was you, no, maybe it was a guest author, but about Kennedy's civil rights policy. I wonder if you would...
Oh, no, I did a long four-part series on this.
So it was yours then, about...
On Kennedy and the Kennedys and civil rights.
Yes, go ahead.
And the reason I did it is because I noticed all these horrible books that were coming out around the time of the King anniversary, okay?
Yep.
50th anniversary. And I kind of figured something like that would happen, you know, but I didn't think it would be as bad as it was, but it really was as bad as I thought it would be. And so I went ahead and I spent about 3 months researching a four-part series. And I'm really glad I did, you know, because let's put it this way, and I'll stand by this statement as long as I live. The Kennedy brothers did more for civil rights in 3 years than the 16 presidents before them did in a century. And there's no other way to get around that statement because it's simply true. Now, what makes that so bad is because the Brown versus Board decision was decided in 1954. And I'm sure everybody understands how important that decision was. All right, because it reversed the Plessy versus Ferguson decision of 1896. That decision essentially said that segregated facilities are not necessarily unequal, and therefore the Supreme Court was ratifying them, you know, which is one of the craziest things that the Supreme Court has ever decreed. All right, but thankfully, in 1954, the Warren Court reversed that decision, except there was one problem. Actually, there were two. The South was not going to go along with it, and in fact, they actually had fiery speeches that we should defy the Supreme Court. All right, if they want to send in troops, but we will not go along with this willingly, and Nixon and Eisenhower essentially nodded, gave those a kind of nod and a wink. They didn't really make a big deal about the defiance of the Supreme Court. All right, and so almost nothing was done about civil rights, you know, during the Eisenhower administration. The entire 8 years, the Department of Justice filed something like 10 civil lawsuits, 10 in 8 years. And by the way, two of them were on the very last day of the Eisenhower administration. So in reality, they filed 8, one a year. All right. Bobby Kennedy doubled the amount of lawsuits that were filed during the entire Eisenhower administration in 1 year, the first year he was in office. Okay? He made a speech at the University of Georgia. I think this was something like in March or April, in which he spent half the speech talking about the Brown versus Board decision, which is something that Eisenhower nor Nixon nor any of their attorney generals ever did the entire time they were in office. But in 3 months after Kennedy was elected, inaugurated rather, Bobby Kennedy goes to the University of Georgia, all right, and makes a speech about how he's going to go ahead and back the Brown versus Board decision. All right? And right out of the chute, the Kennedy administration did exactly that. You know, in the New Orleans case, in which there was a judge down there, okay, that went ahead and decreed that the New Orleans City School District should go ahead and begin to integrate, all right, met all kinds of resistance. I mean, all kinds of resistance, you know, by the state legislature, by the local powers that be. You know, he got very little help at all from the attorney general, all right? And so what Kennedy did, what Bobby Kennedy did, is him and Burke Marshall, his special assistant on civil rights, they went ahead and they indicted the Secretary of Education in the state of Louisiana.
And by the way, we should mention that among the things that the forces that killed Kennedy hated him for was his civil rights policy. In fact, Guy Bannister, in addition to his federal and anti-Castro Cuban activities, published a thing called the Louisiana Intelligence Digest, which specifically targeted the civil rights movement, which was made out to be a communist conspiracy.
Correct. Yeah, that was Guy Bannister.
Right.
You know, these people were so far right that they really believed that Moscow was behind the civil rights movement, which of course is absolutely nuts. You know, but it did create a problem. Okay, with King's direct, you know, communication with JFK. All right, because you know, JFK said once words of the effect, my God, every time Martin Luther King comes to the White House, you think we're being visited by Karl Marx, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so Bobby Kennedy did a lot of communicating with King by telephone, all right, instead, all right? And so what happens next is that there was another case, school integration, okay? And this took place in Virginia, Prince Edward County. And to show you how bad this was, all right, and to show you just how, you know, who they thought won the war, okay, the Civil War, the state of Virginia, all right, went ahead and decided that they were going to go ahead and take away state funding for public education, all right? I'm not kidding, by the way, all right? I actually did a lot of research on this, all right? And they were going to go ahead and turn state education into private education, all right? And that was the way that they were going to go ahead and defeat the Brown versus Board decision. And, of course, you know where most of the money was going to go. It was going to go to these white schools, these white academies.
Sure, sure. Well, and something of the legacy of that area right now is playing out as the Democratic governor of Virginia is resisting calls to resign after he was photographed in blackface. So there was a blackface picture of him in, I think it was his medical school yearbook. I'm not sure.
Yes.
And that culture is very deeply ingrained in Virginia, as it is in many other southern states as well, of course.
Now, if you can believe it, Eisenhower and Nixon did nothing about this. Nothing. Okay. In fact, when one of the students went ahead and wrote a letter to Eisenhower, he got a letter back saying words of the effect, you know, well, I'm sorry, but education is a state obligation, and I really, my hands are tied. All right. Well, when Bobby Kennedy and JFK got into office, guess what? They started condemning the whole state of Virginia and Prince Edward County specifically, saying that it was a blight on the nation. And they will do something about it no matter what happens. So they began to file lawsuits in Virginia. And because the state, the highest court in that area was dominated by the Republicans, they weren't successful. But you know what they did then? They did something that, for the life of me, I believe is completely unprecedented in, you know, in history. They went ahead and they arranged for a friend of Bobby Kennedy named Bill Vandenhoevel to start up a whole new school system, replacing the one the state of Virginia had taken away. But I'm not kidding. You can actually, if you go to Google and you look up Prince Edward County school system, you'll see stories about this, all right? And so William Vandenhoevel raised something like $1.4 million, okay, from private foundations, all right? And he spent 2 years of his life constructing a whole new school system out of nothing. I mean, he hired a superintendent. He began hiring teachers. He began hiring a clerical staff. He began renting buildings, all right? He set up a whole semester system. He had a staff start calling all the kids because they hadn't been in school like two or three years, okay? And they said, well, you know, we really don't have any clothes, and my son doesn't have. And he set up a staff that went ahead and bought the clothes. They bought the shoes. They delivered them to the people's homes. Once he got the kids in class, there were kids who didn't even know how to use a pencil. Okay? And he did something revolutionary. He went ahead and got the... I used to be in public education. I would be lucky if I would have 35 kids in a class. That'd be a relatively small class. Okay? He got the ratio down to 16 to 1.
That is really good.
I don't tell you how important that is. You know anything about education? Because if there's one thing that all the research bears out, the smaller the class size, the most effective the instruction. Okay? He got it down to 16 to 1. And then because the kids had been out of school for so long, he did away with the grade system. In other words, there was no like 10th, 11th, and 12th grade. Okay, it was that he would just group them according to the testing they did before the kids came into class. Have you ever? I'm telling you, I'm not kidding about this. If you don't believe me, look it up online. You can find it. It's one of the most amazing stories that, you know, that I've ever read about.
Is this okay. included in your series about Kennedy's?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
One thing that I want to call to listeners' attention. Send me, after the show, send me the links, and I will include those links in the written description for this program. Go ahead, Jim.
Okay. All right. And so that was the first thing that they did, okay, is they began to attack these school districts who were resisting the Brown versus Board decision. Then the other thing they did is they began to shift to higher education, all right? And so there were many colleges in the South that were doing everything they could to resist the Brown versus Board decision. And so the Kennedys decided to attack this problem, okay, by going after research grants, okay, and prizes that the federal government will give out to these higher education private schools like Duke and Clemson, all right? And they actually said, we are going to make this contingent upon you opening up your whole admission system and proving that you were accepting applications from African-American students. And so that's what happened. They couldn't they could not get along without these grants, and so that's what opened up these private colleges in the South. All right. Now, the other thing, of course, was the public colleges. And what I'm talking about there, of course, are two big celebrated cases are at the University of Mississippi and the University of Alabama. Okay. And that is where the Kennedys had to go ahead, and because the governors of those two states, Ross Barnett and George Wallace, were so resistant to change and to the court system, the Kennedys had to go ahead and do the thing that they really didn't want to do. They had to bring in the military to go ahead and do something about it. And so what happened there is that at Ole Miss, Edwin Walker had started a riot. He had come there from Texas. He lived in Dallas, all right? And what happened was that due to some mistakes in planning and the fact that their communication system had collapsed, there was a 2,000 or 2,500 Klansmen, you know, and right-wingers outside the University of Mississippi, and Kennedy did not get the amount of troops there that he needed fast enough, and it devolved into a riot, okay, and two people were killed, and finally, in the middle of the night, General Creighton Abrams finally got the, I think it was 15,000 armed troops onto the campus, all right, to quell the violence. And what happened is that Kennedy escorted James Meredith, the student who wanted to go to the University of Mississippi, to class for his whole college career with two Marines next to him because he was so worried he was going to get killed. Now, at the University of Alabama, all right, the University of Alabama, what happened there was that Robert Kennedy tried to get a agreement with George Wallace. But George Wallace was determined to make a really big media spectacle out of this. And so what happens is that Wallace brings in 900 state troopers and highway patrolmen to block the entry of Vivian Malone and James Hood. Bobby Kennedy had to bring in 3,500 troops, all right? And then they had a fallback plan that if Wallace still resisted, that they would go ahead and nationalize the state National Guard. And so that's what they ended up doing, all right? They nationalized the state National Guard, and the guy came up on in a Jeep, an Army Jeep, and essentially said, Mr. Wallace, if you don't move away from this door, I'm going to have to forcibly move you away from this door on the orders of the President of the United States. So Wallace decided to walk away, and the kids were allowed to go to the college. And to me, that is really, really important because it was so crucial that black Americans in the South be allowed to go to those schools, because it was so important. Because, see, prior to that, which I'm sure you're aware of, there was what they called this historical black college system, you know, like Grambling, you know, in Jackson State and
sure.
stuff like that.
Sure.
Yeah, and they weren't allowed to go to the really big-name schools, all right? And so this was a real milestone in what we call upward social mobility. It was very, very important for them to be able to do that, you know. Now, another thing that Kennedy did is that, and again, very few people know this because it just doesn't get written about very much. Let me finish that one. At the end of the crisis with George Wallace, Kennedy then went ahead and made his famous speech, which I'm sure you're familiar with, his civil rights speech, okay, which was, as many people have said, the greatest speech on civil rights in America since Lincoln, all right? And you can catch that on YouTube, okay? Wonderful, wonderful speech, all right, about civil rights and how important it is to the United States and the moral issue that it does present. All right. Another thing Kennedy did, and again, very few people know this, it was Kennedy who started the whole concept of affirmative action. All right. Yeah, that's something that hardly anybody knows. All right. But this is what happened. During the inauguration, Kennedy's watching the parade go by, and he notices the Coast Guard detail, and he tells Johnson, I didn't see any black faces in the Coast Guard detail. So that night, he gets on the phone with Secretary of the Treasury, Douglas Dillon, and he goes, Doug, how come there were no black faces in the Coast Guard detail? Don't they accept black American students at the Coast Guard? And he says, well, I'll get back to you about it. So that year, the Coast Guard actually began to send out recruiters to something like 900 different high schools throughout the United States. And they began to specifically interview young black American students. And they began to, for the first time, accept black students at the Coast Guard. Now, that's only the beginning. A few weeks later, Kennedy held a meeting of his entire cabinet, and he told them in advance, I want you to bring down how many people work in your department, how many people are black Americans, and how many of those black Americans have low positions or high positions in the government. All right? So they bring down all these figures. Kennedy is very unhappy, okay, when he sees it. All right, and he says, all right, we're going to do something about this. And he passed the first affirmative action law for government hiring, that you had to interview, you had to seek out and interview minority people to put them in positions of government. All right, that was the first time that happened. And so for the first time, America finally gets a black American ambassador to a European country, for instance. All right. He then expands that into government contracting. What I mean by that is that the government sends out literally hundreds of millions of dollars every year to get products made for it. You know, whether it be for the military, whether it be for NASA, whether it be the State Department. Kennedy expanded that affirmative action law, that anybody doing business with the government had to prove they were abiding by minority hiring. So for the first time, you had black Americans working in textile factories in South Carolina. Okay? For the first time. And they said, well, it's either that or we're going to have to shut down. So we're going to have to hire black Americans. All right? And so that's what they did. All right. And so the other thing that he did, he began to go ahead and raise money from private foundations to go ahead and start voter registration drives in the South, because they found out some rather staggering, you know, when Bobby Kennedy sent his assistant, John Doerr, to go ahead and figure out what the statistics were in the South for voting. They found out that, you know, like in one parish in Louisiana, you had 2,845 whites registered to vote and no African Americans. In another parish, you had 4,000 African Americans in the parish, and only 25 were registered. So Bobby Kennedy began to raise money to go ahead and do voter registration drives. This was called the Voter Education Project, which he raised about $870,000, the equivalent of about $7 million today. All right, and that voter registration drive went on for 3 years. Okay, and as one commentator said, quote, it moved Negro registration off dead center where it had been for most of the previous decade and reestablished momentum, unquote. Now, another thing that they did is they worked with the Fifth Circuit down in the Deep South.
Jim, let me just break in there because we've got about 3 minutes left. So.
Oh, okay. All right. With a guy named Frank Johnson, who was a very esteemed judge, and they began to break the back of voter restrictions in the South by having these rulings from this guy who said you could not deny someone the right to vote based on the color of their skin. And that actually became his county, was the first county that struck down voter discrimination laws in the South.
It is really striking how this contrasts with what we are seeing today. And again,
you're exactly right.
It couldn't be more dramatic. And so this is yet another area in which the killing of JFK was quite literally destiny betrayed. And again, send me the links to those articles because I'm sure the audience will want to pursue those. In a past program, I've talked about JFK's jawboning of the steel industry. He also was going to eliminate a major tax windfall for the oil industry. All of this relevant because, once again, the push for greater democratization of economic resources is on the front burner. I'd like to wind this interview up, Jim, by reading a poem that really encapsulates my feelings, not only about Kennedy and his killing, but a great many other things. It's called Be Angry at the Sun by Robinson Jeffers. That public men publish falsehoods is nothing new. That America must accept, like the historical republics, corruption and empire has been known for years. Be angry at the sun for setting if these things anger you. Watch the wheel slope and turn. They are all bound on the wheel, these people, those warriors, this republic, Europe, Asia. Observe them gesticulating. Observe them going down. The gang serves lies. The passionate man plays his part. The cold passion for truth hunts in no pack. You are not Catullus, you know, to lampoon these crude sketches of Caesar. You are far from Dante's feet, but even farther from his dirty political hatreds. Let boys want pleasure, and men struggle for power, and women perhaps for fame, and the servile to serve a leader, and the dupes to be duped. Yours is not theirs. Jim, tell people about Kennedy's and King, Black Op Radio, where they can get the books and the opening. We've got about 1 minute left.
Okay. Kennedy's and King is my website. You can punch through there to buy my two books. I'm a regular guest on Len Osanek's show, Black Op Radio. We need a replacement webmaster at Kennedy's and King, so just email me there, and I will go ahead and respond to you as quickly as possible.
All righty, and for that absolutely riveting discussion on Kennedy's civil rights policy, something you just don't hear, Kennedy's and King, and I'll have the links for those articles in the description for this program. Jim, it has been a pleasure and a labor of love and duty here to do this. And so I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, not only for your work, but for participation in this series of interviews.
Okay, you're very welcome, Dave.
All righty. This concludes For the Record program number 1056, interview number 25 with Jim DiEugenio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on February 5th of 2019. For Jim DiEugenio, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.